Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It is Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer Block. Writer's Block. There's a plural there somewhere. I don't know where. Yeah, my name is Jim Christine. I'm your host, sitting in the studio tonight with Russ Avison, the delightfully charming and lovely Russ Avison. Good evening, Russ.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Man, I'm good. I'm good. We got such a special person on tonight. I'm just excited.
You weren't talking about me.
I'm not talking about Karen either. Although she is, Russ's significant other is in the studio with him tonight.
So yeah. Holding
you can
my
just
hand.
Just wave, Karen.
Yes, everybody wants that.
And the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, California, and Target Freight Management. And we mention Target Freight every week. We mention them because they have full truckload service. That's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload gets you a freight there every time on time? No muss, no fuss at the rates you need for your transportation bottom line. Call them today, 1-844-844-653-7789, and tell them you heard it on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something special extra for you, or extra special, whichever. And while you're at it, if you're an LTL shipper, you are probably looking for the best rates at the lowest possible hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket for getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323. Or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You will not be sorry. And I use them every day, and I am not sorry. Bobby Jean, of course, this is the fourth Thursday of the month. Bobby Jean is at her concert series tonight, in Out West Concert Series. And tonight they're featuring Mike Beck, who I understand is just a tremendous guitarist. And
then what are we doing here?
Musician. I know. I told her, you know, I would go to the shows, except I'm here. So next week, we have a gentleman called Ed Protzel. He's written some stuff. I'm right in the middle of one of his books, actually, and it's kind of interesting. Then April 7th is Doug Sandler. April 14th is Ken Dunn. So, and tonight, without much more further ado, Russ, I'm going to turn you over to the introduction and let you go at it.
Yeah, Sherry Monahan is going to be joining us here in a second. Sherry began her author career when she printed her first book, which was Taste of Tombstone. That was in 1998. And she's had a passion for food and the history of food, and that led her to create that first book. And then she also landed a monthly magazine column in 2009 when she began writing her food column in True West, and that was called Frontier Fair. She studies the genealogy of food and wine, and she calls it winestry. So I just found that kind of interesting.
That's great.
Now, besides that, the book that she wrote that I read, which is Mrs. Earp, all about the wives of the Earp brothers.
Right.
And really amazing. I mean, when you look at the history of this, it's it really put into perspective, because I think we've all seen the movies, the Westerns, all about some of the fantasy of what went on, but this really brings it to light and introduces the women of the Earps brings them to light, because nobody really knows much about them. She's also the president of the Western Writers of America. She holds memberships in Women Writing in the West, the James Beard Foundation, the Authors Guild, National Women's History Museum, and the Wild West History Association. Being the president of the Western Writers of America, and you're a member.
I am.
So she's really your boss.
Kind of, yeah.
Anyway, Sherry, I think, is on the line. Sherry, are you there and ready to go?
I am. I'm laughing at the boss comment. I love it.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Sherry.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And that was such a great introduction. Thank you.
Well, you know, we stole it right out of your bio.
except the part of the book about the Mrs. Earps, because I'll tell you, I was fascinated with that. I didn't think I was going to be, and it really was an amazing history of of not just the women, but the whole time period and how they ended up coming to Tombstone and what the different brothers did. And I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Well, I thanks a lot for that. And that really was what I was talking about, is it's always nice to get feedback on a book that you work on, that you put a lot of time and effort in, and that you're passionate about as a writer. But when someone reads it and gives you that feedback, it makes you feel really good that, you know, you missed some family events and you stayed up late researching because it was worth it now.
Well, then I did my job properly, if you feel good.
Hey, I have a question for you, Sherry. This is going along with the Mrs. Earps. At one point in the early 70s, I believe that Virgil and Wyatt were in Peoria, Illinois, and mm-hmm. they were listed as it was Mr. and Mrs. W. Earp and Mr. and Mrs. V. Earp in the what is it called, the census. And yet they were actually running a whorehouse. Is that pretty close?
It is. One of the women, and when I say the Mrs. Earps, I say that not in a legal sense, but that's what the women who called themselves Mrs. Earp
right.
May have not been legal documentation. And in Peoria, Illinois, Wyatt, in fact, was with a woman named Sarah, and pretty likely he was her pimp, but she went as Mrs. Earp, and he called her Mrs. Earp. So I hypothesized that she was actually, in fact, his second wife.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really interesting information that she didn't just stay with him in Peoria. She actually moved with him for a brief time,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of made me think, well, if it was just the docket to say, oh, well, she's my wife and she's not my hooker, then why would he take her to other places unless, you know, he toted his whores around? I didn't really get that, but...
Well, there's a great book for you, Sherry, My Wife, My Hooker.
Yeah,
that's what I should have called it.
You know, that brings up something interesting that as I was reading this, I noticed that, and I made some notes here, so I don't want to get this wrong, but it was around the 1880s, I guess, where there seemed to be some movement to try and stop the brothels, that prostitution was not very kindly looked upon. Yet all of the movies that I've seen, the Westerns, it's like an accepted thing. The men all go to the saloon and they're all going upstairs and being with the hookers and coming back down and playing cards. And nobody seems to really care much about it. So what's the real truth about that?
You know, I think it's a complicated question or complicated answer, I guess, is that, you know, I always say Hollywood does a lot of, takes a lot of liberties when it comes to Westerns, mm-hmm. often.
Mm-hmm.
And so you did have, when you were in a cow town, it was perfectly acceptable to have that scene in a movie where you've got cowboys going in and finding a soiled dove downstairs and taking her upstairs to one of her cribs. Perfectly acceptable. That would have been normal. Nobody would have given a hoot. If you did that in a city like Denver, in any proper establishment, it just was not, you did that secretly. You know, it was around the 1880s when the West started becoming more settled and towns started to have, the women were there and you had churches and schools and kids. And as you get towards the 1890s and towards the turn of the century, you go from this really rough and tumble male-dominated place where you are now having some civilization and women come along and say, hey, what's going on here? And things start to turn around, and that's where you start to see this clash of it being really unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So where did we screw this all up?
Well, that's when they started moving the cribs back behind the main section of town, wasn't it?
I see.
There you go.
Yeah. And I had a long conversation with Roger McGrath one night. Mm-hmm. He's an ex-UCLA history professor. He's talking head on the History Channel a lot.
I know. I used to watch him and my good friend Paul Hutton.
Yes.
And I'm like, and Leon Metz. And,
right.
And one year I gave a panel at Western Writers of America, and Robert Upley used to be on those too.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am at a panel as a speaker, and I'm next to Robert Utley on one side and Leon Metz on my other, and I'm thinking, how the hell did I get here?
Same way they did, on your foot. But anyway, Roger and I were discussing saloons versus dance halls versus mm-hmm. gambling houses.
Yep.
And he said the saloons were strictly for men. There
yep.
was no women allowed
nope.
anywhere in the building. They just were not allowed. That was the men's refuge. The dance halls and the gambling houses, women were more than likely to go, and then that's where they had the upstairs hookers, and then of course they had the brothels. Mm-hmm. So it's
and he is exactly correct. I mean, I remember in my Tombstone Treasure book, that's about the silver mines and the saloons. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of research, and this was the case in occasional saloons out west during that time period. Is that in Iowa? So this is one of my books. The saloons themselves, the word saloon is where men went to talk politics, read local mining newspapers from home. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to have a woman in there barking at them all the time. The only time you may have had a woman in there is if she was a singer. And she may have been singing some very classical songs. It wouldn't be that, hurdy-gurdy kind of thing.
Right.
It was very classical.
Right.
That's about the only time, and that was very infrequently that would happen.
Right. My wife, Jerry, and I go to Tombstone. We used to go a lot. We haven't been there in a couple of years. But it was my understanding, and I think this is correct, is that at one time across from the, what's the name of that place, that the old theater?
The Birdcage.
Across the street and upstairs, there was a brothel. Downstairs was a saloon or a dance hall or whatever it was. And upstairs, the rumor was that Big Nose Kate had a brothel up there. I don't know if that's true or not.
I've never heard of Big Nose Kate running a brothel in Tombstone.
Yeah.
I've never come across a business license for her, and you had to have a license
right.
to be arrested.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it didn't exist. But I have never, in all of my research, and I've been steeped in Tombstone since 97 mm-hmm. for research before the book, I have never come across that. But you never know. Things are always possible. It's hard to document history.
Well, I think it came from that guy that was killed. The guy that used to run the Birdcage, oh, God, what was his name? Jerry knows. She'll probably call and tell me.
That's your contact.
Yeah, she will. She likes to keep me straight.
Let me ask you, being apparently the only one who's never been to Tombstone, what is it like today?
Wow, it's quite different. I'll create a little scene for you from 1883 in Tombstone, 1881, 82, and 83, all about the same type of thing. Population was at its height at about 7,000 people. Now, Tombstone today, when you walk down Allen Street, which is the main thoroughfare, it's your very typical wide western street with, buildings on both sides. Back in the day, you had two- and three-story buildings. Today, they're all one level, although some have, two-story facades to give you that feel. It was a hustling, bustling town. There were stamp mills pounding. Noise was all the time. If you didn't hear noise, you knew something was dreadfully wrong in Tombstone because of all the mining and the milling that was going on. Saloons were open all night long. There were churches. There were women. It was a very bustling community. Life was happening. Today, the streets roll up about 5 o'clock. Nothing is going on. It looks True. Like a ghost town. It's just not the same. But you still get nothing has grown up around it. Like you could go to Denver or you can go to a lot of historical cities and there's just stuff all around it and it's sort of tucked in. Tombstone, you can still pull up today and still get a sense of what it was like when you would have pulled up to it in the 1800s.
That's true.
Have they tried to keep it more to the original 1800 look, or has it actually grown? And
no,
so it's
not really.
It's a tourist town, basically.
It's definitely a tourist town.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when you have the diorama of Tombstone,
and you have the reenactments and people hawking their brochures on the street.
Right. Yeah, that's why we don't go anywhere.
That's kind of a shame, though.
Hey, you.
It is, Tombstone is a crazy place. I mean, some of the locals, they hate the tourists, but without the tourists, they couldn't live there.
That's true. Actually, my cousin went to go visit, and she liked it so much, she bought a house and moved there.
Really?
And then she got so sick of it, she left.
It's a very strange place. I mean, my husband and I own 40 acres of ranch land just outside of Tombstone. It's beautiful. We go camping there. I had thought about retiring there one day. May still do it, but, the jury's still out on that.
One last question. What is the population there now?
About 1,500.
Yeah.
It's not a very small little town.
And they it's amazingly enough, the city council still has fights with the marshal's office.
They do?
It's still going on from the 1800s.
They don't shoot each other.
No. But they're constantly at each other. It's just real funny.
They are. Some things never change, even over time.
They didn't learn. It's 100 years, they still didn't learn. You cover a lot of that, however, in The Wicked West. The galloping your horse into the saloon and the soiled doves, and I know that used to happen, especially in places like Abilene and Wichita and Dodge, before they got some semblance of law and order there. and amazingly enough, you did mention, and I have to applaud you on this. You did mention the cocktails that were served in the saloons, because a lot of people were under the horrible impression that all they had was beer and whiskey.
Yeah, and they just did shots, and yeah, that another Hollywood myth where the cowboy comes sauntering up to the bar and says, you know, give me a shot of whiskey,
right,
you know,
right.
and you know, it just, again, when you get into, and I always preface this, is that there were some places where that was your only choice.
Sure.
You had nothing but a shot of a rot gut, and if it didn't kill you or make you blind, you were lucky.
Yep.
but that was rare. I mean, that was out like in a Nebraska prairie where they had nothing and no supplies, and,
right.
and that building often functioned as the church and the town hall and everything
right.
else.
Right, right.
But when you get into places that had either railroads or stagecoaches that could bring in supplies, and they had some kind of money, a tiny bit of money, you would have had very popular drinks. You would have been considered, you know, some kind of a ruffian if you were drinking a shot of whiskey from a bottle. I mean, you'd have been tossed that on your ear in many of the saloons.
Yeah, the gin fizzes were pretty popular back then.
I mean, whiskey, you know, whiskey, of course, is synonymous with the West. I mean, you would have whiskey punches, whiskey cocktails. There was a drink called Claret Sangaree. Tom and Jerry were very popular. Mint juleps, eggnog, beef tea.
Wow. So it was really a lot more sophisticated than Hollywood would let us to believe.
Sure.
It very much so. I mean, bartenders, their appearance was, they were wearing white, not aprons, but the long cloths from their waist
to
their shoes to cover them up. And they had things on their arms, and their bars were spotless. And it was very, very different than what the Hollywood would lead you to believe.
So let's go back to your inception into writing. 2009, you wrote, what was your first book?
Taste of Tombstone.
Taste of Tombstone. What got you into writing that? I always like to find out what kind of like motivates people to write something.
Taste of Tombstone. That was my first book. I had never written a book before, but I had written, you know, for the local high school paper and, you know, did some promotional stuff, I guess, for free. And I just decided that I really would like to be a writer, but didn't know what to do with it. So I went to Tombstone for vacation in 95, I think it was. And I thought, you know what? And one thing that I love is I love food and wine. Mm-hmm. I'm a foodie. And I wanted to be a chef and own my own restaurant. Didn't happen, but, you know, food has always been sort of at the forefront for me. So when I went to Tombstone, on the way home, on the plane, I started thinking, you know, I would love to be connected to this town. I just felt like I had lived there in another lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, what did they eat back then? You know, what was their food like? And that's, you know, led me to one thing, to find an antique dealer to ask about menus, and then discovered that they were actually printed in the newspapers that I could get on microfilm. And I didn't want to write a book about Wyatt Earp or the gunfighter Doc Holliday, because they had been done, and, you know, I wasn't in that realm. I had never written before.
Right.
And so that's how I ended up with Taste of Tombstone.
Oh, well, kind of go through some of the food that is in there, because I there's a lot of stuff that I'm sure that I wouldn't eat.
Well,
I thought you eat everything, Jim.
No.
There's not that many weird things in there.
Well, they served Rocky Mountain oysters?
No, not in Tombstone.
Oh, okay. That's a good thing.
No. The thing to remember about the probably from like 1870s to the 1890s, is that trends were very popular, and if you weren't, I mean, keeping up with the Joneses literally came from around that time period, and if you weren't doing what was trendy and sophisticated at the time, then you just didn't have a place in society. So despite the fact that people were in Tombstone or even in Virginia City, anywhere out west, the very trend at the time was classic French food, even printing menus in French, even if you couldn't speak French.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tombstone had a ton of money. They were very wealthy because of the mines, and so was Virginia City and Denver. And so they were eating classic French food and oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I'm just looking at some of the recipes from the book. And, you know, ham with champagne sauce, apple fritters, They had almond cakes. They had chicken giblet soup. Mock turtle soup was very popular. Lobster, chicken gumbo. A lot of the chefs that they hired in the restaurants had come off of the riverboats in New Orleans and off the Mississippi. So there was a sort of a Creole flavor to a lot of the recipes, too. Yeah. And then you had, you know, something called croquettes de volaille aux asparagus points, which was chicken croquettes and asparagus. I know my French wasn't very good there.
Just fooled me. Just that. Rolls off your tongue, doesn't it?
Oysters were very popular. It was a huge thing. You know, liver and bacon, not my favorite. Yeah, and for the holidays, they had the same kind of things we had, turkey and pumpkin pie mm-hmm. and, you know.
And I know that Nellie Cashman's wasn't called Nellie Cashman's back then.
No, she actually had a couple of different restaurants. Right. The American House was the first one. The Russ House was probably her most longest running restaurant.
It was, the Russ House. That's where I saw a copy of the Bill of Fare.
Uh-huh.
And yep. Their breakfasts were pretty what we eat today.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You know, bacon and fried potatoes and... You know, and
you know, cornmeal mush or oatmeal. Pretty much what we would eat today.
Coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, today, you know, it's $19. Back then it was a dime.
Exactly.
All right, Sherry, I'm, you know, as I was contemplating some of the questions that I want to ask you about the recipes, because I didn't read the book about the recipes, mm-hmm. Two things came to mind. One was how sophisticated were the ingredients that were used in cooking then versus now? And secondly, how much time was actually spent preparing food? Because it seems to me it would take a lot longer because they didn't have, you know, the modern conveniences that we have now.
True. The actual ingredients themselves were pretty much what we use today as far as basic cooking. There was not a lot of fancy ingredients. Because you have to remember that things were not easy. I mean, they did import things. I don't want to give you that impression that they could get imported items, but I rarely found anything that I couldn't make a recipe from. Everything was very recognizable to me. I honestly don't remember anything that I went, what is that? So I don't think the recipes, the ingredients themselves were much different than what we have today. As far as the prep work, because of the modern conveniences, when you would cook, for example, you would have a stove that had an oven housed in it. It was a one-unit piece, kind of like a lot of us have today. And the only way to heat it was with coal for a long time. And if you ever see an old recipe, you'd say bake in a moderate oven, bake in a hot oven. And that was basically the cook was able to put their hand over the heat of the cast iron, and temperature-wise, they go, okay, yeah, that's hot enough. They wouldn't touch it. They would just hover their hand over it. So just starting the stove was a labor of love. Mm. In the wintertime, you would keep it burning all the time because you would use it for warmth, and making food in the morning was easier. But in the summer, you'd have to stoke it up every day.
I would have kids to go in there and tell me how hot the oven is.
Yeah. one of the other things to remember is that we have the modern conveniences of if we are going to make a lobster salad, you know, we get the lobster and we take mayonnaise and we add mustard and, you know, we put all those things together and we've got a quick salad. A lot of the condiments that we have today were made from scratch. Ketchup, mustard, mayonnaise. Mustard sometimes came in a dried form. So a lot of the condiments and the sauces and stuff all were from scratch. So those were made, those took a lot longer.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd be able to open a jar of mayonnaise.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not until the 1900s, early 1900s, yeah. I think, or maybe late 1890s.
You know, one other thing, that going back just a minute, you said that things became very trendy. Such as the French cooking. But here you have Tombstone out in the middle of nowhere, from what you've described. And how long did it take for these trends to move around the country? Because, you know, we didn't have, you know, the social media. We didn't have fast ways to get anywhere. It seemed to me it would take a long time for these things to move around. And by the time, say, you had things coming out to the West Coast, the East Coast already changed. They were into something different. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that happened for, it's kind of like, you know, today where things happen in Europe and then the U.S. finds out about it a year or two later and they keep up with the trend. I mean, I was in Belgium a couple of years ago and the trendy thing were the gold-colored pants. And they weren't, nobody was wearing them here in the States. And then like a year later, everybody's wearing these gold-colored pants.
That's what I'm wearing now.
So, and they do today. And it's not like it's sort of that way now. But the thing that was probably the biggest way to set those trends and to let the West Coast know what was going on in the West was by periodicals.
Right,
there
catalogs.
There were Ladies Home Journal, there was Godey's Lady Magazine, Good Housekeeping came along a little bit, you know, a little bit later, and newspapers. Newspapers constantly reprinted stuff from back east. You'll see excerpts in the newspapers all over the West that were like, okay, this recipe was printed from the New York Times, or this one was printed from the Boston Globe. So they were spreading those trends around pretty quickly, considering that was the only way that they got noticed.
Sure.
Interesting.
Sure, and you get the businessmen coming into town from the East Coast that were following the gold strikes and the silver strikes, and they're bringing it with them, too.
They are, and you know, it's really timely that you asked me that because I was just in Boston, got home yesterday. I was up there for a quick overnight trip, and I'm writing my Frontier Fair column in October is about cultural bread in the American West. And I did a little bit of preliminary research, and one of the things that I saw and I had picked up before was that who hasn't heard of the Parker House Rolls? You know, you have a Parker House Roll for holiday, right?
Yeah.
And so this was all over, and Boston cream pie was very popular out west. So why was Boston cream pie so popular? Well, people from Boston and the East Coast took it out there. Well, I ended up staying at the Parker House that was built in 1855 in Boston, and they're the people who made the Parker House rolls.
Did you have one?
I did. I even got the recipe.
It figures.
Of course I did. And they only gave it to me because it was a secret. It was a closely held secret from the 1850s up until the 1940s when Eleanor Roosevelt wanted to have the recipe for a dignitary party she was having, and the chef was supposed to be sworn to secrecy, and, well, it's public knowledge today.
Well, now, your next book will, of course, be publishing the recipe for Parker House Rolls, so there you go.
That'll be in my October Frontier Fair column in the newspaper, in the magazine, so anybody can have it.
There you go. It's all makeup. What the hell? Let's kind of switch gears here for just a moment. What compromises your writing day?
Oh, my God. Ask me on any given day, and it'll tell you something different.
Well, that's the whole deal. Give me a synopsis.
I usually start out my morning with a cup of coffee, and I go through my emails. I try to get I'm kind of squirrely about emails sitting there. They nag at me all day. If I don't take care of things, I feel like I need to respond. I will go through Facebook and see if I have a Facebook page strictly for media, you know, to promote my book and to promote things that are going on, and that automatically feeds to Twitter. So I do a little social media. And then I sort of look at my schedule, okay, what is the most pressing thing that I have that's got a deadline? And that's what I work on.
Well, you're a very busy girl. I mean, you know, you were always saying, well, I'm going here, I'm going there, I'm going here, I'm going there. I was just in, you know, when do you have time to be home?
You know, I'm home more than this.
Really?
I've been home for most of the, starting in October up into right about now, I'm usually home the winter and sort of goes slow. And then starting in March, April is when things, conferences and trips and research things start to happen. And through the summer, it'll be crazy. And then September, October, it falls off and I get a break.
Oh, cool. Hey, next, starting probably, let's see, what's today? Thursday, Friday, Saturday? You may get a Saturday, but probably Monday, you're going to be getting a writer's block mug. So
okay.
You can start your day by drinking coffee in your writer's block mug.
Well, how awesome is that?
And then all we ask is that you take a selfie holding your mug and put it up on our writer's block page and Facebook.
I can do that.
Oh, you're awesome. And God bless.
I can totally do that.
Speaking of writer's block, have you ever had it?
You know, I don't know that I've had writer's block because I write nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so nonfiction, I've always had details in front of me, and I can always try to find a way to do something with the details.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of writer's block for me as a nonfiction author, I have lack of inspiration, I guess.
Oh. Or desire.
That's the term for nonfiction writers, where I just feel like I'm not motivated. I'm like, all right, I know I have all these projects. I know I have massive deadlines, and they're not getting done, but I just don't feel like doing it. And so that's my block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough because, you know, once I get going, I love it, and I'm into it, and I'm in a rhythm, and it's exciting, and then I have to stop. And then when I stop, as long as I'm back in that mode the next day, I'm good to go. But then some days you just get in that little low of, oh, I don't really want to do this.
How far did you get into cooking, into culinary?
You know, I took 2 years of college with restaurant management. You know, I learned about the business aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I went to apply to chef school, and my mom took me, and we went through the whole school program and what it was going to be like. And at the very end, the people taking us said, okay, we want to have one of our chefs come out and just give you a quick talk. And the chef said, I just want to let you all know that if you embark on this career, that there's something very important you need to know. And that is that you need to work, you are going to work nights, weekends, and holidays, and you're going to work minimum of 80 to 100 plus hours per week. And I turned to my mom and I said, can we go now?
Yeah, my son's a chef, and he's finding that out, that it's a lot of work. It's a lot
It seems
of work.
So glamorous when, you know, Gordon Ramsay does it.
Yeah, well, but he gets to yell at everybody.
Exactly.
If you want to call and talk to Sherry, the number here to call is 818-602-4929. That number again is 818-602-4929. Get your pencil out. And if you want to talk to Sherry, she's a fabulous woman. Just give her a call. There you go. See, what kind of a plug do you need, man? I just, you know,
that's
fabulous.
So awesome.
That's a great word.
You guys are rocking it, I'm telling you.
Hey, have you seen the film with Seth MacFarlane, A Million Ways to Die in the West?
Sadly, yes.
Okay. Well, no, it was fun. It was fun, as long as you don't take it seriously.
But, it was entertaining.
Yes, it was. But there was something interesting in that film that I thought about as I was looking through the photographs in your book. And what is the deal with nobody smiles in pictures? In the movie, they made a joke. They said, oh, yeah, I've heard that if you smile, you'll explode. But really, you look at the photos and nobody smiles.
You know why?
I don't.
Two reasons.
Okay.
Okay, Sherry, go for it.
There are two reasons why. Is one, the photographs back in the day was a very long process. And so it could take up to 15 minutes for a shutter to actually click. And so imagine sitting today, posed for a picture, and you start out smiling. And then 15 minutes goes by, your face is tired, and you're just like, take the damn picture already. And the other thing was, is that when they used a flash, you know, that poof that you would see,
right?
It actually oftentimes was like nitroglycerin or dynamite. And so if you ever notice people that look scared to death, it's because they were scared to death because they had just had dynamite go off in their face.
Well, you know, another thing I always noticed about old pictures, and my great-grandparents are the same way, is that the man sits and the woman stands behind him with her hand on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
I always kind of chuckled at that because to do that now, oh, I'd be in trouble.
Right? Photography of the 19th century.
You'd be lucky to be in the same room.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, you know my wife. But
don't get me in trouble.
Oh, I know, huh? I know, huh? Tell me about your wine experiences, because I like wine too, but I'm not a big wine drinker, but I do enjoy a glass of wine occasionally.
Oh, wow. Yeah, how far back do you want me to go?
However far back you want to go, it's your hour.
Well, let's see. I was drinking your pretty much average wine that every 20-something drank, you know, Sutter Home, you know, the White Zinfandel.
God.
And I met some people in California who are my friends now, and they were really into good California, well, all good wine, but a lot of California wine. And they slowly, you know, turned me on to really good wine. And the thing with once you learn to drink good wine versus bad wine, is you can't go back.
No.
Is you can't go back.
No, you can't.
And so I've over time your palate changes, and the types of wine that you liked 5 years ago may not be the type of wine that you like now. And so as I was learning more and more, My husband and I, we have a couple of wine stores, and we go wine tasting there on the weekend. And I was at one of the wine stores, and they knew I loved history and wrote about the West. And the wine guy said to me, we were trying a Segesio. And he said to me, oh, my God, Sherry, you're going to love this story. You know, this is about an Italian guy who came over to California in the 1890s, and he worked there with the Italian Swiss colony for 5 years, and then he became his own winemaker. And that's a great, and I was like, oh, my God, that's a great story. So, you know, my little wheels are going. I was like, well, if there was one guy that did that, and are there wineries today that are still tied to the 1800s, and how cool would that story be? So that's when I came up with the California Vines, Wines, and Pioneers book. And there are over 60 wineries in that book that are still in business today, so that they have to have a historical tie, whether they're using old vines, an old building, or they're a historic family. I wanted my readers to be able to taste history in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of my love of wine and how I got started with it.
Are there any vines that are currently producing that were around at that time period?
Yeah, there are. They don't produce a lot because the older they get, the slower they become. Sounds pretty familiar, right?
Sure, yeah.
I'll attest to that.
You know, I have a citrus ranch, and the same thing happens with the citrus, is that as the trees get older, they produce less, and they slow down, and it doesn't, the flavor's not as good.
Yeah, doesn't the fruit get smaller too?
It does.
It does.
You see more fruit, but they're not as large.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, you'll see, a lot of it is the Zinfandel, because that was what it was originally planted in California. And that you'll see old vine Zins. And those are from older vines. And that's where you tend to see most of the old grapes.
There's a lot of wineries sprouting up now around Santa Maria and Santa Barbara, and actually there's a really big one down in the desert, Temecula.
Oh, yeah, that's a big wine-making area.
Yeah, they're just going to town down there, and they're making all kinds of wines. And I mean, California, of course, has got some of the world-class wines, so you know, it's no wonder everybody wants to end on the act.
Yeah, back in the late 1800s, what were they considered the best wines, as far as where did they come from? What were the great wine producing areas?
Well, you know, Napa and Sonoma were two of the, you know, the two places in California, only because that's where you had people like Charles Krug and Agustin Horasti, who is the self-proclaimed Count of Buena Vista. And they did extensive research, and he traveled all over the world and brought back several, you know, hundreds of vine clippings and experimented with different things. And so they really became attuned to what would do well in California, because the old Mission grapes that they had were just terrible. So you had people like a little bit later than that, you had the Behringer brothers, and I'm trying to think some of the other people that I've written about. But one of the best wines, Charles Krug was really well known for his wine.
Interesting. Those are a lot of names that are still popular today.
Yeah. But, you know, the Behringers and Italian Swiss colony, not so much.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah. But then you also have Robert Mondavi, who makes a great wine.
You do. And actually, Charles Krug Winery is owned by Peter Mondavi.
Oh, okay.
When the brothers split off, Peter Sr. and his brother Robert, Peter Sr. wanted to make sure that the Krug Winery stayed true to its heritage and its roots, and the other brothers said, no, we want to make wine. Mm-hmm. And so the Peter Mondavis kept the Krug Winery. And actually, in my California book, Peter Mondavi Jr. wrote the foreword for me.
Oh, well, shut my mouth.
And I went to meet him after the book came out, and Peter Sr. came in, and oh, he was a hoot.
What's your favorite wine? What's your favorite wine?
It used to be Zinfandel until I did this book, and I started to learn about Petite Syrah.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I fell in love.
I've had some of that before.
Yeah.
I'm a Pinot guy myself.
I like just about every red wine, and I love Chardonnay.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Wow. That's kind of like soda pop to me.
I love a California Chardonnay. I don't like necessarily the oak, but I like the creamy, vanilla, buttery, popcorn kind of Chardonnay.
Yeah, that's what I like about the Pinots. They're real good ones. They're real buttery when you drink it. They're just really tasty.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, talk about holidays on the frontier, if you can. if you want to give some of that away.
Know?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you've got it as a release date is summer of 2016, which is going to be about 3 months away.
Well, unfortunately, that's not going to happen. it's been pushed back to 2017.
Oh, okay.
Not quite as inspired on those, some of those mornings, huh?
Yeah. Well, let's just say that it didn't come together the way I wanted it to come together. I had hoped it would come together, but it's still a good story, and it will be out next year. But, you know, holidays on the frontier, I talk about the traditions and, you know, how they were celebrated out west. And, you know, a lot of them are similar to what we have today. But, you know, Christmas, just for example, Christmas, most people did not have a Christmas tree in their own house. Mm-hmm. It was usually at the church or a local meeting center.
Right.
If people got a Christmas present, it was usually a piece of fruit or something practical.
Right.
Not like we celebrate today.
Right, right.
Thanksgiving, this is the fun thing I love about Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving back then was a very religious holiday, and it was about family reunions. And they played football. It was a football day.
Really? Well, that's
what year was this?
This is the 1870s.
They played football?
Yes.
Was it more like
local towns, and they all would get together, and it was a huge thing.
Was it like European football, soccer, or was it actually oblong, ugly American football?
It was ugly American football, the cross between a European version. It was a hodgepodge for a while,
but it was
very similar to the American football.
How interesting is that? I've studied all this whole time period, never knew they played football. I knew they played baseball.
And they did baseball. July 4th was a huge thing for baseball.
Yeah. And, amazing. And you're also working on, or possibly you're not at this point, When the Rich Went West.
Oh, yeah. That's a story that I had been working on for quite a few years, and Ethel will get her due one day. It's a great story, and it's a tragic story all rolled into one. You would swear it's a fictional story. Briefly, it's this family who was from England. She was from a fairly wealthy family. Her father was a musician who started off writing religious music and then became involved with the Crystal Theater, Crystal Palace Theater, not the Crystal Palace Saloon, but a very well-known theater in Richmond in England.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband was the son of a man who worked with the king. He would actually do treaties and stuff, so he was very well-connected. And she dumped her original fiancé, who was a wealthy Irish nobleman, and within 3 weeks married Gerald, this guy that she ended up going. He lost all of his money, and they wanted to go to California and make it rich. And so these white-collar stockbrokers were ushered off with allowances from their parents and decided to go to Lake County, California, and they were going to be ranchers there. They failed miserably at it. She ended up having her cousins come out. She ended up having an affair with one of her first cousins who had married her chambermaid. They all went back
to San
Francisco.
These are the stories I like.
Me too. These are stories we like. Keep going.
Okay. These are stories you like. Of course you do. it gets better, trust me.
Okay.
They end up forming their own acting troupe, and they act at the Athenaeum in California, and he ends up getting a call from a woman, and he goes back to England and performs on the stage, falls flat on his face, never comes back to America, leaves his wife and three children here to have an affair with her first cousin.
Oh, no.
They have a nasty divorce in 1898 that makes the New York Times. She ends up living and finally marrying. He got custody of the kids. In the divorce papers, it says that he can remarry whenever he wants. She cannot remarry until he's dead. So she ends up living with this cousin, Claude,
there.
Till the husband dies, and then they finally marry.
Wow.
Did he die of accidental causes or?
No, he died. He died of the pandemic in England.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, he remarried and had a child. And then Ethel and her cousin Claude lived here for forever. She finally got back to her beloved England, and then he died. And then at the age of 72, she marries an Irish nobleman.
I believe it was the guy
she dumped for her husband, Gerald.
Huh. Go figure.
Yeah.
And this is all true.
I made none of it up.
I know, but as I'm listening to the story, I'm thinking I could see this as a series on ABC or something.
Yeah. A 10-part miniseries.
Along with Scandal and How to Commit Murder. And
Oh, there's a lot more because the Ethel's son-in-law is involved with a German actress who, after he shortly visits her, she ends up jumping off the building and killing herself. Although he was completely exonerated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I almost feel like we should be taking notes. you need a program to find out who's who.
Hey, you couldn't write this.
No, you can't make this stuff up.
I had so many details. I treated it as she had kept a journal when she lived in California for 18 months. And in 1886, she had a publisher back in England publish a book that talked about her life there, which is why I have so much detail. But she was cryptic. She made up names. Her name was not Ethel in the book. It was Evelyn. And Gerald was George. So I had to be a detective and genealogist, which I knew professional genealogy, so it really came in handy, and track them all down.
Huh.
Well, I have an Excel spreadsheet with all the details.
Oh, you would have to.
Tabs on it.
You would have to. Hey, look, we're going to be a little short of time here. You want to give everybody how to get a hold of you, website, email address?
My website is my name, sherrymonahan.com.
Okay.
And that's pretty much it. You can get me. I have email on there, my Facebook page, my Twitter account.
We won't give anybody your phone number.
I appreciate that, especially when I'm on deadline.
I know, huh?
And also one thing I'm going to ask you, if you ever are out in California and you do a live show with us.
If you would, studio, that would be wonderful.
But also bring wine.
Yes.
That's what I was really hoping. I asked Jim yesterday. I sent him a text. I said,
is she in studio?
He says, no, she's in North Carolina. I said, oh, darn. We were going to do a lot of sampling.
Yeah, if you're ever out here and you want to come on, just give us a couple weeks heads up. And if we got some space, we'll slide you in.
Well, I will be coming to California in the next few months. I have to do some research on my next book called California Madams.
Well, you know what? You'd be more than welcome to come in and join us in the studio.
And drink a little wine.
And drink a little wine. And it would only be 8 o'clock here.
It would only be 8 o'clock instead of 11.
Sherry Monahan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's
just
been a pleasure.
Real treat having you with us.
And, thank you.
Okay, get some sleep.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, good night, Sherry.
Talk to you. Bye-bye. Sherry Monahan, nice lady. Very well-informed lady,
I might add. Yeah, that was fun.
Yes, she was a very, very nice lady. Hey, I got to make a couple announcements here before we get into our Jimmer Jammer.
Do I need to be sitting down for this?
No.
Oh, okay.
The bookie, as you well know, is mm-hmm. Jerry, and she has sent me with some four people who contacted her that wanted to get on the show. She sent them information. They've never gotten back to her. Now, we only have three spots left for the year. There, I think one in November and two in December, and that is it. And one of these, I'll just go ahead and name these people off in case, and just in case they might be listening. Anthony Gerst.
You're going to call him out, is what you're doing.
I am. Yeah. I'm calling him out. Anthony Gerst. If you're listening, get back to the bookie. She needs to be able to book you and give you some dates. Jim Garrison is another one. He's represented by Jeannie Loyacano. So if you're listening, Jeannie, get on him. Caitlin Leva, and she has also wanted some information on the Writer's Block show. And last but not least, Diane Valeri. And she's Liz Donatelli. I assume that is probably her agent, sent her to us. Holy crap, look at this. I'm showing everybody in the room a picture of what she sent.
Interesting.
A naked man.
Karen's asking if she can see that again.
Here, you want it? And, of course, again, next week is Ed Protzel. And like I said, I'm right in the middle of, his book, and it's really good.
Don't you really want to call him Ed Pretzel? Come on.
No, because I'm going to be talking to him next week. And we promised we wouldn't make fun of anybody except Ed Pretzel.
Okay.
And then April 7th, of course, is again Douglas Sandler, and April 14th is Ken Dunn. He has this big writers thing. He's going to be interesting to talk to Ken because he's got this big consortium of things going on. So he's a pretty cool guy. And I think that's just going to be about it for me. What do you got to say there, Russ?
Good night.
Well, yeah, I guess we can say good night if you want to say good night, Karen. Always a pleasure seeing you. And I guess if we're done, we are done.
Jim, thanks. This was a lot of fun tonight.
Always a great time with you, Russ. And with that being said, we're going to take you out in a rush.